This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Our program takes a holistic approach in addressing anti-aging psychology, medicine, alternative medicine, fitness, nutrition, and wellness. Our emphasis is on innovative thinking and practices that have solid data and results. Most of us view disease as bad. We get sick and protest, how unfair. Or we see disease as an enemy that we need to nuke with pills and lasers or a surgical strike. Dr. Shabrow Malalam views disease as a history lesson in how our ancestors adapted to survive the plagues and climate changes and other adversities. He believes these history lessons can help you be healthier. He has a doctorate in physiology and the emerging fields of neurogenetics and evolutionary medicine. He is also completing his medical school training at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. He is author of the New York Times bestselling book, Survival of the Sickest, A Medical Maverick Discovers Why We Need Disease. In the first part of the show, we'll focus on how diseases help us adapt. In the second part of the show, we'll focus on how these insights can help you be healthier and live longer. Dr. Malalam, welcome.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Let's jump right in. How did diabetes help us survive?
I'm glad you asked that. That was the one question that kept coming up while I was doing genetic research, which was, why are certain populations more at risk for certain diseases? And the thing about diabetes that struck me was, you know, Northern Europeans are at greater risk for type 1, which is a very deadly form of the disease. So I started thinking, could it be that diabetes, like other common heritable illnesses, gave our ancestors some type of evolutionary advantage over others? And the one thing that kind of struck me was 13,000 years ago, the Younger Dryas, which was a snap ice age that hit Northern Europe, decimated humans living in that region. And a snap ice age does one thing, especially is a society either has to develop the ability to come up with ways of dealing with the cold. So if it's, you know, building certain shelters or using animal furs, but if you don't have time to develop that, and I mean, this ice age is thought to happen in 10 years, the thinking is then, well, what did the populations that survive have that the ones that died didn't? And the one thing that I think is a possibility is that they had the ability to have higher levels of glucose in their blood, which kind of acted as an antifreeze. And the interesting thing is that there's animals and plants that actually manage the cold in very similar ways. There's a frog, it's called Rana sylvatica, the North American wood frog, that can actually freeze solid every winter by getting reversible diabetes. And it does this by increasing the amount of sugar in its blood and freezing essentially solid. Its heart stops, its brain stops. And then come spring, it thaws out and its diabetes reverses. So, you know, looking at disease in this new way by stepping back and asking how did the disease arise in the first place allows you to kind of find either animals or certain other organisms that might deal with an environmental change in the same way and look for a treatment. For example, using this wood frog that can freeze solid as a way of finding new treatments and cures for diabetes.
Does diabetes, to our knowledge, still have some adaptive value?
Well, you know, you don't need to have diabetes to even see this. A person with a body that can handle sugar in a normal physiological sense, when you're exposed to the cold, you become insulin resistant. And what this means is that, you know, your cells don't respond as well to insulin, and it causes you to have a sugar spike. And that sugar spike kind of depresses the freezing point, which means that you can survive out there at a lower temperature, where someone who might not have this response might not be able to do that.
So are Eskimos and people in northern climates more likely to have diabetes?
It's a great question. I mean, when you look at it, seems to be at least only that when these certain populations that exist today in these northern climates, when they switch to a more western diet, they're more at risk. So it might just be that these populations didn't experience the same amount of pressure as the northern Europeans did when the ice age slid in, since they actually moved into this region prepared. So if you kind of are not exposed to the cold, you don't have this great pressure initially where, you know, a lot of people either survive or die, then you're not going to have this pressure to select for this disease.
So the history for one ethnic group may be very different from the history for another ethnic group.
Yes, and you see this with many other conditions, and even simple things like alcohol consumption. 50% of Asians lack a gene to break down results in is an instant hangover. it's not fun. It's called Asian flush. And if anyone out there is Asian, has this, or has friends who have this, their faces get red right away. They appear tipsy and drunk, but this is almost like an allergic reaction. And alcohol being not broken down kind of properly results in some type of like toxicity. So this makes drinking not fun at all. So the protective value of this is you might not be able to drink alcohol, but then you don't go on to become an alcoholic because drinking is just not tolerable. Now, the big question is why would 50% of Asians not be able to break down alcohol efficiently? And when you look in history, you start thinking, could it be because, you know, when people started living in towns and cities, the first thing that tended to get contaminated was the water supply. And people realized this early on, even before there was an idea of microbes. They just knew, you know, you drink this water, you're going to get sick. It's better to drink. In Europe, for example, they drank fermented beverages. And that process of fermentation and the alcohol that's produced sort of disinfected the water. So people drank dilute beer and wine all day. Or all day long. And in Asia, they went of a very different direction. They boiled their water, added a few tea leaves, and drank diluted tea all day long. So you can right away see, well, you know, these Asians, or in Asians in history, didn't have that same pressure to be able to break down alcohol as Europeans might have had. And the result is today that Europeans can break down alcohol, but then if your ancestors are European, you can also go on to becoming an alcoholic.
But the adaptive value was that we can survive polluted water by drinking alcohol instead.
Exactly. And, you know, it almost seems like counterintuitive. But then again, it has that drawback that if you have that ability, then you might get in trouble by drinking too much long term.
Well, it might be helpful when we travel in other countries.
Right.
What about obesity? Is that adaptive in certain circumstances?
Most definitely. I think if you, at least your ancestors, experienced an environment where access to food was very limited, then the ability to pack away whatever you eat onto your body in the form of fat is something that is very beneficial. It allows you to survive a time of famine. So, you know, when you look around and you see, when they say people have a different metabolism, you know, if some people complain, no matter what I eat and I exercise, I just can't seem to get the weight off. It just whatever I eat kind of ends up in my belly or my thighs or wherever. And this is in a way a very complicated blessing because it's evolution is trying to help you survive, and it's the one thing that would have kept your ancestors alive while everyone else died when there wasn't enough food. But today, again, when calories are so plentiful, and that doesn't always mean that there's a lot of nutritional component to it, but there's a lot of calories that are available, then most people, or those people whose ancestors experienced that lack of food, will tend to become obese and then have all the associated health problems long-term with obesity.
So in America, we have a mixture of people whose ancestors adapted to shortage of food, but we also have some people who didn't have that problem and can eat all day long and never gain a pound.
Exactly. And again, a lot of it might have to do with what our ancestors ate. I think the most perfect diet that would be, you know, the ancestors' diet, which if you could figure out what they were eating. And just an example would be if you know, up until very recently, your ancestors were doing a lot of hunting and fishing and not agriculture, then your body will have the ability to not, or actually will lack the ability to break down a lot of complicated carbohydrates. So you might be prone to diabetes. But if your ancestors were doing a lot of farming, and there would be this push to be able to break down these sugars throughout a long lifetime, so to have a pancreas that can deal with all these sugars might be a good thing. But again, when we talk about America, this is such a melting pot now that it's almost like, you know, a deck of cards has been mixed. We have such varied ancestry, most of us, that it's a very difficult thing to do. We might have one gene that evolved to protect us under one environment and not another. And go around, you see skin type. Dark skin arose to protect people from too much sun. The problem is our bodies need to make vitamin D, and we make it largely through the sun using cholesterol. Now, if you don't get enough sunlight, then you're going to be at risk for not enough vitamin D, which possibly could be a risk for cancer. And you see this because, I mean, African Americans seem to be at much greater risk for prostate cancer when they live in the northeastern United States than when they do down south in Florida. So it's very interesting.
Because they're not absorbing enough sun?
Exactly. I mean, that might be the case. It's still controversial, but to me, it seems to make so much sense because not only are they storing too much, they're not getting enough sun. When you do follow a blood test, you find that they are lacking vitamin D. We arose this kind of complicated arrangement with the sun to be able to produce this important vitamin.
Could that be corrected just by taking vitamin D?
I don't think so, and I think this is where my opinion kind of departs radically from most dermatologists, at least, which is there was an interesting campaign put out by the indoor tanning movement to get people, increase business, let's get people tanning indoors and get them to increase the amount of vitamin D they have. And of course, that's not a good idea because, again, you're going to be putting yourself at risk for skin cancer. But I think if you're taking something that is synthetic or in a synthetic form, because a vitamin in a bottle is not the way your body has developed over millions of years to deal with, so it's never going to be the same. And it might not even be the exact form that our body needs. And vitamin D is very complicated. It actually has all these precursors that go from cholesterol in the process to conversion to finally to vitamin D. And it may be that one of those kind of molecules in the middle or the middle step might be the one that's important for cancer. And by taking the vitamin in a pill form that's been synthetically produced, it might not be actually the right form that our body needs.
And that's probably true for a lot of vitamins.
Exactly. The best way to get vitamins is through the diet. I mean, there's no arguing that.
And best sources of vitamin D in the diet are?
Well, it's going to be usually fortified in milk and, certain cold water or fatty fish, such as herring.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is when you look at people living in the north, you mentioned, the Inuit, they have actually darker skin because when they moved up, they moved from regions that were actually much warmer. So this kind of goes against the idea of pigment in their skin. How are they getting enough sunlight? And, you're wearing parkas and you're covered. Well, they don't have that problem because a lot of the fatty fish that they're eating or a lot through their diet is very rich in vitamin D, and they consume a lot of animal fats in the form of blubber.
And if that hadn't happened, they would have died off.
Exactly.
Now, you've done a lot of research in Alzheimer's. Does that have an adaptive factor?
Not Alzheimer's per se, but a gene that puts you at risk for it, I think, has an adaptive value. And this is one of the only genes that seems to really correlate very strongly with what's known as sporadic Alzheimer's disease. And it's called APOE. And the specific variant is called E4. There's a lot of people that actually don't want to know that they carry this gene because it puts you at risk for Alzheimer's. Having one copy increases it by 3 times, having 2 copies almost by 8. But like all genes, this one in particular, most people who carry it actually don't go on to get Alzheimer's. So it doesn't really kind of help you to know that you have it. But again, I ask the question, why do certain populations have this gene, this variant, this E4 variant that puts you at risk for cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's? Why is it so common in Northern Europe and not in Southern Europe? And again, it comes down to our complicated relationship with the sun. Because having this variant, this E4 gene, that puts you at risk for Alzheimer's, also puts you at risk for having too much cholesterol in your blood. And the protective value of that, like, why would it be a good thing to have too much cholesterol? We're bombarded constantly with fears of staying away from foods that have too much cholesterol and take lots of drugs to lower your cholesterol. Well, that's true if your cholesterol is very high, but actually our bodies evolved to have levels of cholesterol to be able to convert that into vitamin D. So if populations are living, such as Northern Europeans, in a place where there's not enough sun, the one thing that their body can kind of correspondingly do is increase the amount of cholesterol that they have to make up for the loss of sunlight. And by doing that, ensures them to get enough vitamin D converted. So this gene most likely, and this is the theory that I was working on, arose to protect these populations, Europeans living in a place where there's not enough sun. The long-term consequence, though, having too much cholesterol from this gene is going to be cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's disease. But both populations didn't live long enough to suffer those effects. And most of these decisions were done short-term. Your body, through evolution, is going to come up with ways to kind of counter the long-term threat. It's better to deal with something that may come in the future if it keeps you alive in the present.
Mm-hmm. Would you want to know whether you have the APOE gene?
It's a great question, and I had opportunities to find out because, I was involved in many studies, and we were testing for this gene in the lab, and I most definitely would not want to know because there's nothing really that I can do if I do have this gene. And like I said, it's such a high percentage of people who carry this gene don't go on to develop Alzheimer's disease, then I just may be worrying myself sick over something that may not happen at all. And I think the most important thing is that most of the genetic variants that we have are not deterministic, meaning you have this APOE4 gene, but 90% of people with it don't go on to get Alzheimer's. There are many genes, though, that, and they're rarer, that are, say, the one that can cause cystic fibrosis. And, knowing if you're a carrier there will make a difference, especially if you're planning on having a family.
Could you elaborate on that? I think most people have the idea that you have a gene or you don't, and you get the disease or you don't. What else goes into the equation?
Well, all these other genes working in concert, and I think that was the big shock that came out of the Genome Project, which was the estimated number that scientists were predicting based on all the proteins that we have in our body and all their functions was that we would have around somewhere between, 90 and 120,000 genes. Well, it turns out we have less than 30,000 genes. And the reason is many genes can actually, or one gene can produce many different kinds of proteins. And the easiest way to explain this is, you can take the word, I'd say a gene that codes for the word time, where you can mix up those letters and make another word called emit. And genes work in the same way. They can make different kinds of proteins from the same starting material. So what this means is that you can get all these different arrangements of proteins based on the same genes. So in a sense, identical twins who have the same starting DNA, they're completely identical. They don't get the same diseases all the time. They're more at risk to get them. So it turns out that all these genes kind of work in concert with the environment. Some of them get turned on and off depending upon what you eat and what you do. And all of that interaction, which is this amazing complicated dance, really determines what happens to you health-wise in your life.
Would footnote what you said about the APOE gene in that as we get closer to getting a cure for Alzheimer's and treatments for Alzheimer's, then it might be very advantageous to know.
Sure, exactly. And then the big question is going to be, and I think this is the important thing, is that the future of a lot of our medical care will depend on the genes that we have, especially when it comes to the way drugs will be prescribed. And this is going to be very important because for a long time, physicians knew that different percentages of the patients that they saw, and some got, very bad side effects, some actually needed a higher dose of a drug to get the desired effect. And now we're figuring out and realizing that all these differences in people are somewhat genetic. So having that information is very empowering. And from the point of view that if you know that you have a specific gene that you might need a higher level or a higher dose of a drug, and you see this, some people who are very sensitive to caffeine or very sensitive to cold medications, they actually may be sensitive to at least a third of prescription drugs, and they should really speak to their physicians about these sensitivities because it would really change the care in which they're getting. And this is kind of like the future when people talk about personalized medicine. It's looking at the specific genes that you have and figuring out the right drug that you might need to treat a certain.
The futurists have described, you go to your doctor and he runs some tests to profile all your genes, and then they run it through the computer and know what medicine to give you. But what you've been describing suggests that it's far more complicated than that, that we would have to put a lot of lifestyle factors and diet and that kind of thing into the computer to get the optimal diagnosis and treatment recommendation.
Exactly. I mean, this is still, we should stress that even with our most optimistic hopes, this is why medicine is still and will for a very long time be an art and not a science. Because it's going to, you're going to have to kind of look at numbers and find out the best way to find that treatment. It's not always completely deterministic just based on these genetic tests.
Or if it's deterministic, it's far more complicated than we can imagine
exactly.
At this point.
Exactly.
How is depression adaptive?
That's a great question. I think it depends on how we look at depression. Having, some people describe having a depression that is a normal response to life allows us, to mourn specific situations and pick up and move on. If we didn't have those the kind of normal response to life, then, when you look at certain people who've lost a partner that they've had for many years, 20, 30, 40 years, and in a couple of years they go through some type of emotional state, but coming out of that state allows them to, at least approach life in a very fresh way, and if it is to find another partner again or to keep on living, to some degree, having the ability to go deep in the psyche and, I guess, you know, face some very dark emotions that some of us have to do at certain points in our life could be somewhat adaptive. Again, it's the idea that some people might be more prone to entering these dark places and not being able to come out might be the negative side or the downside to that sort of specific ability.
And people who have a very biologically based major depression that's very intractable, that fits the same pattern?
It may very well be. You know, some people describe, and again, this theory is very controversial, that people who have that more biological tendency to experience depression might at some point have an ability or some degree of creativity on the other end. But again, it's very difficult to know when we talk about genes and the environment being psyche and being complicated. I think when it comes to our psychology and the way our minds interact with our body and our physiology, that's a completely other level when it comes to complexity.
Mm-hmm. Cancer is this trade-off between growth and not growing. Did all the different types of cancers, were they individual adaptions to different problems at the time?
It may very well be that some of the cancers that are more common are, just like you mentioned, the ability for tissue to grow. Having that ability, of course, it can run wild and the body can kind of lose control over the growth of specific tissue. But it also is what allows us to repair parts of our body and to keep us healthy and alive. I think the interesting thing on the horizon is that a lot of certain cancers that we've thought of as solely is arising within the body and just being some, you know, type of mutation gone wild, so to speak, may actually have some type of infectious origin. And I think that after H. pylori was discovered to be the cause of most duodenal ulcers and a risk factor for stomach cancer, I think people now, or researchers at least, are reevaluating human disease and asking, you know, are a lot of the cancers that we're seeing, could they have some type of infectious component? And this is going to be a very interesting field as we use a lot of molecular tools to kind of investigate and reevaluate what we may have thought of as a cancer, and maybe it is in fact infectious.
You're listening to Ageless Lifestyles Radio on webtalkradio.net. We'll get back to our guest in a few minutes. I'd like to talk to you first about one of the benefits of the Ageless Lifestyles Institute. I often see companies which have grumpy old man syndrome. It's like you're in a Dilbert cartoon or a Garfield cartoon. People who really don't want to be there, who are pessimistic and negative. Worst case scenario is when you get a customer calling, say, I will never do business with you again after the experience I had with customer service or the experience I had with tech support. It doesn't have to be that way. In the movie Grumpy Old Men, there was a wonderful solution. Aunt Margaret came into town. And suddenly, Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau stopped being grumpy old men and really perked up. Well, most companies can't afford to have Aunt Margaret come in, and if they did, the women would probably want equal time of George Clooney. And hiring both of them to come in on an ongoing basis gets pretty expensive. A much more practical solution is to have me come in and teach people how to think, feel, look, and be more youthful. I do that with keynote speeches, I do that with consulting, I do that with workshops, and I can do that in a remarkably short period of time at a very modest expense. Employers love it when they have happier, healthier employees who are more productive, need less sick leave, and need fewer health insurance benefits. Check out antiagingspeaker.com, that's antiagingspeaker.com. We're talking with evolutionary medicine researcher Dr. Sharon Malalem, M-O-A-L-E-M, author of the fascinating, very readable, and often humorous book, Survival of the Sickest. It is one of the few science books to be a New York Times bestseller. His website is www.survivalofthesickestthebook.com, all run together, survivalofthesickestthebook.com. Dr. Sharon Malalem, how do you view illness now? Has your research changed your whole outlook on what illness is?
It really has. I think stepping back and asking these deeper questions, you know, why do people get sick? Is illness a part of the natural state for humans? I started to view illness as some type of complicated blessing, especially illnesses that may have arisen through evolution to protect us. I'll give you just a brief example. The one gene that I was studying intensely, it's responsible for a condition where your body absorbs too much iron from the diet. It's called hemochromatosis. It turns out that more than 1 million Americans may be at risk for this condition and not even know about it, because the result of having too much iron, of absorbing it from the diet, is other things such as it comes out at least as diabetes or heart disease or liver problems. And in reality, it could be simply treated, because the treatment for this condition is just going and giving a blood donation, possibly at the Red Cross. And I kind of looked at this condition and said, why is it so common in Western Europeans or people of that ancestry? 30% of them carry genes that put them at risk for this. And again, it didn't make any sense to me. And looking at it as a complicated blessing, I stepped back and I said, could it be that it protected past populations from some horrible event? And the one thing that really struck me when I looked at what happened in Western European history was the bubonic plague. And the bubonic plague, or Black Death, wiped out parts of Europe over successive centuries. And in some areas, it's 30 to 50% of Europeans died from this horrible infectious disease. And again, could it be that hemochromatosis, the disease we see today, could it be that it protected those Europeans from bubonic plague? And in reality, the ones, you can imagine Europeans living in that time 700 years ago wondering, why are certain people dying? Why are others surviving? And it might just be that it was this genetic mutation. And it's a complicated blessing, because if you survive the plague, well, that's great. You get to, your lineage continues. But it becomes a complicated blessing, because you end up, especially today when we live, we have much longer lifespans, then you end up kind of having the negative part of that blessing, which is being at greater risk for things such as liver cancer and diabetes. You never kind of get off for free in this complicated arrangements that we have in the world.
One of the reasons I was especially interested in your work was the way you called it a blessing. So instead of being angry about having an illness, we can step back and say, what's good about this and what can I do about it, instead of just being consumed with anger or depression.
Right. And it's a very difficult journey to have to be able to go through a medical diagnosis, and especially when we're talking about something which is serious. And, if someone comes down with such a serious diagnosis, almost the last thing that they want to hear, this is a blessing, because it seems to be only a curse. But I guess it's like you're saying, if you frame this in your worldview and your understanding that the reason that you got sick is also the reason why you're alive in the first place, because it's what kept your ancestors alive during some awful kind of predicament, it is somewhat empowering, because it kind of helps you to reframe your illness in some type of historical, long view, instead of just focusing on the short term.
And another thing I think it does, when you were talking about iron, understanding the big picture alerts us to issues. For example, knowing what your iron level is when you get a blood test at the doctor, that may influence, for example, whether you want to donate blood or take iron supplements. To use your phrase, whether you're at risk for rusting to death.
Right. And I'm so glad that you brought that up, because most physicians are not even aware with our complicated arrangements or relationship with iron. For so many years, the view was the more iron you give people, the better, really. And this is kind of really being reevaluated, because the first things our body does when it is sick, or even if the body has cancer, it goes through this phase called the acute phase response, where it hides all the iron, because not only do microorganisms that cause infection eat iron, cancer cells do too. So people who have cancer sometimes appear to be anemic on some blood tests, but they're not actually anemic. It's their body's response to the illness. And the physician, in trying to help that person, actually may prescribe them iron, which is completely detrimental, because it may just end up feeding the cancer and kind of overriding their body's natural response. So by stepping back and really taking the long view and trying to really consider what our body is doing, and if it is doing the right thing, does the body know best in some instances, can kind of help us to treat illnesses and conditions in a new way. And, the new view now is to try to find certain drugs to treat cancer, but that limit cancer cells' ability to take up iron, just like you would want to do with microorganisms that are infecting you.
Do you subscribe to the theory that menstruation is one of the reasons that women live longer because it gets rid of excess iron and possibly other toxins?
When it comes to iron, most definitely. I really, and again, this is controversial, so there's many different views on this subject, but my take on it is, especially when you look at the data and you say, well, why do women not have the same rate of, say, cardiovascular disease as men until they hit menopause, and then it's kind of women can catch up and go beyond men in some situations. And the only other thing, of course, it could be is hormonal. That's the major kind of difference that you see through menopause. But when you look at the studies that have the hormone replacement, and you don't see the reduction that you'd expect, to me it really looks to be that it's iron, especially when you consider and you bring in this wealth of data from studies looking at people who donated blood long term. And people who donate blood for many years seem to be much healthier, lower instances of cardiovascular disease, for example, especially men. And then the big question is, for researchers, they started thinking, well, could it be that people who are donating blood, are they just more health conscious and that's why they're going and giving blood? But to me, it's just more evidence to the case that, well, removing the iron that's in the blood, which makes the blood red, which we might possibly, or some of us might have too much of, might be the thing that is actually protecting us long term.
And so for women, the benefits of donating blood actually increase after menopause.
Yeah, most definitely. And if, if there's any women that are interested in giving blood, of course, you should check their iron levels initially with their physician. But if they get the okay, that might be a way of protecting themselves long term. And unfortunately, the studies just haven't been done looking at this properly and saying, for example, if I get a hysterectomy done at a young age and, of course, they stop menstruating, again, they're at higher risk for cardiovascular disease, even with hormone replacement. So this might be something that many women curse over their lifetime, but at some level, again, stepping back, it might be the one event that is protecting them from certain cardiovascular conditions.
Mm-hmm. We're taking an awful lot of antibiotics. Does that have an effect on what you're finding?
I think so. I mean, it must be having some type of effect because you can't really take drugs and not have any effects at all. So the one interesting thing that we have to think about is most of the organisms that inhabit us, and we're talking, if you'd be able to separate all those microorganisms, it's a few pounds of our weight are actually the microorganisms that inhabit us, and most of them seem to be friendly. And the interesting thing is that, when you hear about probiotics or friendly bacteria, such as those ones, lactobacillus, that is found in yogurt, they actually don't need iron. They're very rare. There's these exceptions. And part of their way in which they protect our health is that they're almost like squatters, that we kind of let them live on us, in us, and around us. And by them taking up base physically, they protect us from other organisms that might want to move in and mine our iron, for example. So taking too many antibiotics or antibiotics for conditions that might just be viral, we may be undermining our own health because we may be removing these organisms, and many of these organisms are also involved in the production of vitamins for us as well. So by kind of indiscriminately carpet bombing and declaring war on all these microorganisms, we may be losing out on certain strains that we may have been receiving that have been handed down over generations. So, our parents or our mothers especially have been kind of infecting us over many years with these protective strains. So by taking antibiotics, we may be getting rid of things that their natural kind of way in the way they exist in our body kind of prevent us from getting ill.
Parallel to what we were talking about of diseases being a blessing, it sounds like maybe we could view bacteria and viruses as blessing, and that many of them are actually a big help to us, and maybe we shouldn't be so obsessed with Lysol and killing every germ in sight.
Exactly. And, you put it very clearly, by declaring a war on diseases and on the microbes, the one major thing that we're kind of preventing ourselves from really doing is really understanding the intricate and complicated relationships that we might be having, and we may be missing out on the benefit, at least especially when it comes to these microorganisms, and just wanting to use antibacterial soap and creams to the extent that, you know, we're kind of being too clean. And of course, we shouldn't undermine antibiotics. I mean, part of the reason that we have such long lifespans is partly due to specific immunizations in childhood and having a clean water supply. But I guess taking it to the extreme that we're removing everything, I guess, is this kind of idea of antibiotic carpet bombing, that we might be really harming ourselves, and instead of, you know, making ourselves healthier, we're really asking for trouble.
And I see a lot of people in hospitals and nursing homes that have had a lot of antibiotic treatment but don't get any probiotics afterwards, and then they get MRSA and terrible diarrhea, and it just drags on for months and months sometimes.
Exactly. And again, that's changing, especially when many companies realize that there's a profit to be made. So it seems to pique a lot of people's interest. Say simply, eat more yogurt, there's not much money to be had. But when I think that that's really what we're going to be seeing is certain the packaging of probiotics. And what we're learning is that not all probiotics are created equal. The actual specific strains that we might need perform very differently. And in fact, the shocking example was, you know, there's some study that looked at probiotic replacement, and it actually created some problems for some individuals. So it may not, again, be such a pill solution to a problem. It might just simply be that we should be eating foods that are rich in probiotics, such as fermented foods such as sauerkraut or yogurt.
I think there's great comedy in this stuff. There's profits in bacteria, and our bacteria is better than your bacteria, so pay a premium price for it.
Right. This might sound humorous, but it's true, and I think that you're going to see a lot of interest in mining people's bacteria to find magical strains that seem to really promote health. And it's going to be interesting to see who will own the rights to these bacteria that are discovered. If they're discovered, it's the individual, you know, who it was found inside of, or the person or the company who actually found it.
Well, we thought we had silly lawsuits before, but now we'll have lawsuits over who has rights to germs.
Exactly. I don't think that's far-fetched at all. And it's going to be very interesting to see how the courts would actually have to deal with such issues, you know, which might now sound, again, humorous, but will be actually very important when you look at the importance of these microorganisms and, I guess, the big income that people hope to get through them.
You write about how a pregnant woman's habits can change or affect the baby's genes. Can you explain that?
Sure. So, I mean, the new big interest now is this field called epigenetics, and this is coming back to that realization that identical twins with identical DNA don't have the same lives. They don't go through the same life course. And what's interesting when you look at pregnancy is the child that's developing within his mother or her mother will experience the environment through the womb. And in that way, the mother is constantly kind of communicating certain lessons about what the environment is by, and the way this works genetically is genes can be through this process called methylation, be turned on and off. And the thinking is, at least, that if a mother is consuming a lot of empty calories, for example, food with not a lot of nutrition, that might signal to the developing child, whoa, I'm about to be born into an environment where there's not enough food, because our bodies sense, they don't have calorie detectors, they have nutritional detectors. So sensing that lack of nutrition, the child might then be kicked into a certain mode that we talked about earlier, where there isn't enough food and you're shifted, or the body shifts to a state that can lead to obesity, which is, if a child's thinking that it's not going to be born into an environment with enough food, then its response, at least, will be to preserve as many calories or nutrition as possible. And in a way, then, if what the mother eats is affecting that generation, the next generation, because the next generation can become much more obese.
So are you suggesting there are critical periods when genes get turned on or off, and that may stick with us for the rest of our lives?
Yes, especially in development. I mean, this process of genes coming on and off are happening constantly in our body. When a physician, you know, tells their patient that you might experience side effects in the beginning, but after a few weeks your body gets used to it. Well, What does that mean? What does it mean? How can a body get used to a drug? Well, what that means is if it's being, the drug is being detoxified by certain genes, those genes need to kind of come online. They need some time to rev up their production to be able to break down that drug. And that process, really, which happens throughout life, it's very critical during development because it seems at least, and it would make sense from an evolutionary perspective, that a lot of the settings that happens during initial development then is very difficult, or might be much more difficult to change after the child is born.
I have to ask you about Toxoplasmosis gondii. It sounds fascinating. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So this is this parasite that you can kind of acquire by eating certain undercooked meat products, and you can, if you're exposed to cats that are infected with it. You know, for many years there was this association, which was very controversial, which really saw that people who were exposed to this parasite seemed to be at greater risk, and especially if it happened in the younger years of life, you seem to be at a greater risk for developing schizophrenia later on. This was, of course, very controversial because how could exposure to a parasite cause such a complicated condition as schizophrenia? It didn't really make sense to anyone, and it remained fringe for a very long time, and until recently when some experiments were done and with mice, and mice were infected with this parasite, and what they found was that the behavior of mice changed radically. Mice usually are very scared of cats, obviously. They want to survive. They don't want to become the cat's lunch or dinner. And when they're exposed, not even cats, if they're just exposed to the urine of cats, they become very fearful and tend to run away and hide. Well, what they found out was that when this parasite infects mice, and remember, this parasite has the sexual part of its life cycle only in cats. When the parasite infects mice, mice lose their fear of cats and the cat urine. And they also become very fat. It almost seems as if, and I'm not trying to give life to this parasite, that this parasite is doing this intentionally, but the infection of the parasite causes the mice to lose their fear of cats, so they can be eaten by cats, and then this parasite can go on and infect the cat where it wants to get to. And so the interesting thing is this is the same thing happening in humans. Is it might just be that people who are at some type of risk for developing this condition, having this parasite might kind of shift their bodies or put them at much more risk for going on and developing schizophrenia. So it's really important that for people who have cats, not to get rid of their cats, but to at least, you know, change that cat litter often. And the most dangerous period, especially, is if a woman is pregnant, let someone else change the cat litter and be careful not to become infected with toxoplasmosis.
Do you put any credence that it might possibly make women more attractive and warm-hearted and even promiscuous?
You know, again, I included different views on this topic. I think at this point that might be a little bit of a stretch. At least doing the studies to prove if that's true might be very difficult. But you never know. And, you know, I mentioned this before. Who would have ever thought that there would be bacteria discovered that causes stomach ulcers? You know, everyone thought that the stomach is the most acidic place in the body and it's sterile and nothing can survive. And lo and behold, there's this bacteria who not only survives the stomach, it thrives there. It produces ammonia and neutralizes the stomach acid and has a field day. So, you know, having this parasite that changes our behavior might not be that much of a stretch.
Could you wrap up by giving us a vision of how you think the future might be in the next 10 or 20 years in this area?
Well, we mentioned personalized medicine. I think the biggest impact that people are going to see on an individual level will be when they go to their physicians. Many of these tests will come down so far in price that it'll just be a part of standard care. So you're not going to be screened for disease genes. You're going to actually be screened for which variation of a gene do you have. And before you get prescribed any type of medication, this information will become crucial. I think of course we're living in this information age, but knowing what genes you have and how that affects your health and especially your medical treatment will become crucial. And again, it's all going to come down to the issues of cost and availability, because having that knowledge might be expensive. And again, this raises the issue, you know, why should you have to pay someone a royalty to be able to look at your own genes? And unfortunately, at least currently, that is the case, and it's going to be interesting to see what the future holds, if this is going to be revisited. But I think the one big change will be, you know, I think genetics coming and playing a much bigger role in our healthcare. And possibly also getting this knowledge will help us to be able to know what foods we might have to eat. You know, there might be some of us, based on our genetics, that might need less meat, or that might need certain amount of, or an increased amount of antioxidants. And again, knowing this information, I think, will really help people to lead longer and healthier lives.
Fascinating. And my hope is that it'll be like cell phones and computers, that the technology will trickle down quickly and become very inexpensive very quickly, but the legal implications of it might slow that down.
Right.
Some.
Right. But and again, you know, that's what I'm hopeful as well. When you look at some of these tests, the hundreds, if not thousands of dollars, so to get all of the variations done, it may just be, you know, we can really hope that it will be like cell phones, where, you know, it's very democratizing to see that so many people can now kind of afford a cell phone, that, that hopefully at least that people will be able to afford these tests. But when you look at healthcare and the amount of people that are uninsured at this point, it's going to be really difficult to say who's going to be the one to pay for this new type of healthcare.
We've been talking with evolutionary medicine researcher Dr. Sharon Malalem, that's M-O-A-L-E-M, author of the fascinating book Survival of the Sickest. It's a New York Times bestseller. His website is survivalofthesickestthebook.com. That was survivalofthesickestthebook.com. A simply fascinating read. Dr. Malalem, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, I mean, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed speaking with you today.
I like to leave listeners with a baby step to help them live longer, healthier, and happier. You may have guessed what today's baby step is. I'd like you to remember sometime in the past when you were ill. Perhaps it was a serious disease. And I'd like you to think back on how that disease might have been some adaption that your ancestors made, and how that disease may have been some kind of adaption that helped your ancestors survive. And when you do that, perhaps you can even see it as kind of a blessing. Then I'd like you to think that without this blessing, without this disease, my ancestors probably wouldn't have survived, and I never would have been here. Given that trade-off, how can I make the best of this situation? What can I do to help me get over this disease or this illness and prevent it from reoccurring again? The advantage of this kind of approach is that instead of getting angry, instead of getting depressed, instead of feeling sorry for yourself, you take a much more optimistic, positive road, which results in you being more likely to manifest a healthy immune system, to manifest the energy, to manifest efforts and critical thinking that will help you find what will help you get better, help you find what will prevent this from happening again. Now I'd like you to imagine, if you were to get sick in the next several months, what is the most likely illness that you would get, and how this might have been something that back in the past helped your ancestors survive, but not something that you want to get now. Seeing it as that blessing that helped you survive in the past, what can you do now to prevent that illness from manifesting itself? And see yourself tracking down the information that you need to answer that question, or taking the actions that you need to take in order to prevent that illness. Rather than being at war with illness and germs, see yourself as increasingly understanding how the system works and learning the system so that you can benefit from that knowledge. This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio. If you like what you're hearing, then you'll love my free email newsletter, the Defy Aging Newsletter. Every 2 weeks, I give very practical advice on little baby steps that you can take that'll help you think, feel, look, and be more youthful. And I also throw in humor and a few quotes. To subscribe, all you have to do is go to drbricky.com. That's drbricke.com. And you can't miss the sign-up form to just ask for your name and email address. If you have any comments on the program, please send them to radio@drbrickey.com. That's drbrickey.com. This is Dr. Michael Bricky on Ageless Lifestyles Radio on webtalkradio.net, thanking you for joining us on our quest to think, feel, look, and be.